Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something really universal, so common you almost don't think about it seriously enough.
Right, soft tissue trauma.
Exactly. It feels like the definition of an underestimated injury, doesn't it?
It absolutely is. You know, people like, oh, a cut, a bruise, minor stuff. But our sources, they really hammer home this fact. Soft tissue injuries, they're the leading form of injury worldwide.
Wow. Leading form.
Yeah. And your skin, which is your body's biggest organ, that's your main line of defense. It's critical.
Yeah. Okay. So our mission today is pretty clear then. We need to get past just, you know, what these injuries look like. We want to dig into the anatomy underneath, understand how the body actually repairs itself, which is frankly amazing, and also cover some, well, maybe counterintuitive ways we should manage them, priorities.
And maybe the biggest one, the key rule right up front. Always, always look for other injuries first. Serious stuff. Life threats.
Before you get sucked into the soft tissue damage?
Precisely. That, you know, dramatic bleeding, it's designed to grab your attention. But maybe there's internal bleeding or some other major trauma from the impact. That's usually the thing that'll kill the patient faster. Don't get distracted.
Got it. Primary survey first. Okay, let's start with the basics then. The skin itself. Our armor.
Yeah.
We see it as just a covering, but it's way more complex, right? It's crucial for keeping everything stable inside homeostasis.
Oh, it's incredible. It's like this multifunctional shield. I mean, think about it. It protects everything underneath.
Yeah.
It stops you losing too much water, helps control your temperature.
And it's how we feel things, right? A giant sense organ.
Exactly. So to understand trauma, we kind of have to know how that shield is built, the layers.
Right. Maybe instead of just listing them, how does each layer play a part when, you know, trauma happens? What breaks?
Good way to put it.
Okay.
So first up, the epidermis. That's the outer bit you see. It's got five layers itself, constantly shedding and replacing. It's tough against, like, scrapes and friction. But if it gets seriously damaged, say, a bad road rash, a friction burn, boom. That protective barrier is gone. Bacteria can just waltz right in.
Okay, so breach the epidermis, infection risk jumps up. What's next?
Then you're into the dermis, and that's where all the important machinery is housed.
The infrastructure layer.
Yeah, pretty much. It's this tough, stretchy connective tissue. It's got the blood vessels, sweat glands, hair follicles, and crucially for how it feels, the nerve endings.
Ah, okay. So that explains why some cuts hurt way more than others.
Totally. A deeper cut that hits the dermis, you're slicing into or exposing those nerve endings directly. That's why it hurts so much more than just a surface scrape on the epidermis.
Makes sense. And below that?
Below the dermis, you've got the subcutaneous tissues, mostly fat, good insulator, cushion against bumps, helps with temperature too.
Mm-hmm.
And then even deeper, there's the deep fascia. Think of it like a really tough, dense sheet protecting the muscles, tendons, bones underneath.
It sounds like a really well-designed system, but obviously it can fail. When that happens, when trauma gets through all those layers, what are the big immediate dangers?
Right. When that seal is broken, you're suddenly facing three major threats almost instantly.
Yeah.
One, infection. We mentioned bacteria getting in. Two, temperature control goes out the window. You lose that insulation. And three, maybe the most critical, especially with big wounds or burns, fluid balance. You start losing water, losing blood volume. That can spiral into shock really fast.
Okay, so infection, temperature, fluid loss, the big three vulnerabilities. Let's talk about how these injuries happen. Blunt force, penetrating, burns. But the type of wound matters, right? Closed versus open.
Hugely important distinction.
Yeah.
Closed wounds, the skin surface is still intact, but there's damage underneath.
Yeah.
A bruise or contusion is the classic example.
Wow.
And there's a difference there, too. If it's just small blood vessels leaking, you get that spreading discoloration that's ecchymosis. But if a bigger vessel tears and you get a collection of blood, like a lump you can feel, that's a hematoma, often needs more watching because of the pressure it creates.
Gotcha. And then the ones we worry about more immediately, perhaps, open wounds, skin's broken, bleeding, infection risk right there.
Exactly. And here's something really interesting that affects how these open wounds heal. Skin tension lines.
Skin tension lines. How does that work?
Well, your skin isn't just draped loosely. It's under tension, kind of like elastic. And the lines of tension run in specific directions across different body parts. Some areas have static tension, others dynamic tension over moving muscles.
Okay. So why does that matter for a simple cut?
It changes everything about how the wound behaves.
Yeah.
If you get a cut that runs parallel to those tension lines, the edges tend to stay pretty close together. It might even look mostly closed. Heals better, usually. But even a smaller cut that goes across those lines, perpendicular, The skin tension pulls the edges apart immediately. You get this gaping wound.
Ah, so the wound geometry, the direction, is as important as the depth sometimes.
Absolutely. That gaping makes it harder for the first stages of healing to happen,
yep.
And you're more likely to need stitches, maybe even deal with worse scarring later.
That really shifts perspective. No. Okay, so the armor is breached. The body doesn't just sit there, right? It launches a response, this 5-stage healing process. Walk us through the start. What happens right away?
It's immediate defense. First, stage one, hemostasis. Blood vessels clamp down. Platelets swarm the area. The clotting cascade kicks in. Stop the bleeding. That's job one.
Makes sense. Stop the leak.
Then stage two, inflammation. This is your body sending in the cleanup crew. White blood cells, other immune cells, they flood the area to clear out bacteria, damaged bits of tissue, any dirt. Central prep work. Got to clear the debris.
Okay. Site secured, site cleaned. Then rebuilding starts. Epithelialization, neovascularization. Sounds complex.
It is, but it's logical. Stage three is epithelialization. Basically, new skin cells start migrating across the surface, trying to cover the gap.
Okay.
And stage four, neovascularization. Is super important. Neo meaning new, vascular meaning blood vessels. The body starts building tiny new blood vessels into the damaged area. Why? To bring in oxygen, nutrients, the fuel needed for repair.
Like building supply lines to the construction site.
Exactly like that. You can't rebuild without supplies.
And the final stage, laying down the new structure?
That's collagen synthesis, stage five. Specialized cells called fibroblasts arrive and start churning out collagen. Collagen is this tough, fibrous protein. It's like the cement and rebar, knitting the tissue back together.
Okay, so it patches things up.
It does. But, and this is really key from the sources, this new collagen patch, it's never as strong as the original undamaged tissue.
Ah, so the repair isn't perfect.
Never 100%. It's a functional repair, but that area will always be structurally different, potentially weaker.
That limitation is important. And sometimes things go wrong during or after this process, right? Let's talk complications, especially hidden dangers. High-energy trauma often involves crush injuries.
Yes, absolutely. Critical point. With crush injuries, what you see on the outside, the bruising, the swelling, might look bad, but it often completely underestimates the devastation underneath.
The sources really stress that, don't they? The surface injury is almost secondary.
Almost always.
Yeah.
You've got potential fractures, major blood vessel damage, nerve damage, and all that internal injury can lead to really serious systemic problems or limb-threatening issues like compartment syndrome.
We hear that term a lot. It's about pressure building up inside a muscle compartment. Why is that so dangerous so quickly?
Yeah, think of your limb muscles being wrapped in tight bundles by that fascia we mentioned. If you get massive swelling inside that tight wrapper from a fracture, bleeding, the crush injury itself, or even if a bandage or splint is put on too tight outside.
The pressure just keeps rising.
Exactly. And it rises until it's higher than the pressure in the tiny arteries feeding the muscles and nerves in that compartment. When that happens, blood can't get in.
So no oxygen.
No oxygen. Tissues start to die. Necrosis. It happens fast, and if that pressure isn't relieved, usually with surgery, you can lose the limb or worse. It's a true surgical emergency.
Okay, a really serious complication. What about infections? We know any break in the skin is a risk. How do we tell a simple local infection from something becoming systemic more dangerous?
You look for the signs. Locally, near the wound, you'll see the classic signs. Redness erythema, maybe some pus, the area feels warm, it's swollen edema. Maybe red streaks heading away from the wound.
Oh, okay. Those are local signs. What points to it spreading?
That's when you get systemic signs. The patient develops a fever, maybe shaking chills. They might feel generally unwell, maybe even have low blood pressure or joint pain. A fever after an injury like this is a huge red flag. The infection isn't contained anymore.
And some infections are particularly nasty, need immediate aggressive treatment.
Oh, yeah. There are some real villains out there. We should mention three really bad ones. First, gangrene, often caused by Clostridium perfringens. It produces this foul-smelling gas, destroys tissue rapidly, turns it necrotic.
Nasty.
Then tetanus, caused by a toxin from Clostridium tetani. Doesn't necessarily destroy tissue like gangrene, but causes horrific, painful muscle spasms and stiffness. Lockjaw is the classic sign. That's why knowing someone's tetanus shot status is vital.
Absolutely. Vaccination is key there. And the third.
Maybe the most feared, sort of the fastest moving, necrotizing fasciitis. The so-called flesh-eating bacteria. It spreads incredibly rapidly along those fascial planes we talked about, destroying tissue as it goes. Early recognition and aggressive surgery are the only way to stop it.
Terrifying. And we can't forget bites, right? Human, animal. Those mouths are full of germs.
Oh, incredibly high risk. A bite wound, even if it looks small, like a puncture from a cat bite perhaps, can inject nasty bacteria deep into the tissues. You can't treat these like a simple cut. They need thorough cleaning, often antibiotics, and very close monitoring. Way higher risk than a clean laceration.
Okay, message received. Bites are serious business. Let's shift to management. We've got a patient with significant soft tissue trauma, maybe from a major accident. What's the first thing we do? The absolute priority in that XABCDE assessment?
It's the X. Has to be. Exsanguination. Catastrophic hemorrhage.
Stop the bleeding.
Immediately. If you've got massive bleeding from an arm or leg, a tourniquet goes on. High and tight, that takes priority over pretty much everything else in that moment. Stop them bleeding to death.
Control the X first. Once that's handled, let's talk about the common stuff. Closed wounds, bruises, hematomas. Races has been the standard forever, hasn't it?
It has. Rest, ice, compression, elevation, splint. Still the foundation.
Any nuances we should know?
Yeah, a couple of things. Ice is good early on. It really can help reduce that initial swelling and maybe speed things up a bit. Mm. But compression, you have to be careful.
How so?
If you wrap it too tightly, you can actually cause the problem we just talked about, compartment syndrome. So snug support is good, but cranking down on it is dangerous. It's a balance.
Good point. Okay, now for a huge safety rule, impaled objects. Something sticking out of the patient. What's the golden rule?
D-O, not teller. I-T-O-U-T.
Simple as that.
Simple and absolutely critical. That object, whatever it is, might be plugging a hole in a major blood vessel. It's acting like a cork.
Okay.
You pull it out in the field, you risk unleashing catastrophic, uncontrollable bleeding. It's a massive high-risk move you generally don't want to make outside of a hospital. Stabilize it in place with Borky dressings, support the limb, and transport.
So stabilize, don't remove. Are there any exceptions ever?
Very, very few. The sources list basically three situations. One, if the object is physically blocking you from managing their airway.
Can't breathe. Gotta move it.
Now, two, if it's in the chest and preventing you from doing effective chest compressions during CPR.
Right.
And three, if the patient is impaled on something immovable like a fence post and you literally can't move them with the object still in place. Otherwise, leave it alone. Stabilize and go.
Crystal clear. Okay, what about those really dramatic-looking injuries? Avulsions where a piece of skin is torn off but maybe still hanging by a flap?
Yeah, those look awful. The main danger there is that the flap of skin loses its blood supply and dies. So if it's still attached, you want to gently clean it if possible, then carefully fold it back into its normal position. As close to anatomically correct as you can get.
Okay, lay it back down.
Then cover it with a dry, sterile dressing, maybe a compression dressing, to hold it in place and protect the exposed tissue underneath.
Got it. And the most extreme amputations. If part of a limb is completely detached and you, the listener, want to save it for possible reattachment, what's the exact procedure?
This needs careful handling. First, gently rinse off any obvious dirt or debris. Don't scrub it, just rinse. Second, wrap the amputated part loosely in sterile gauze that's been moistened with saline. Just damp, not soaking wet.
Saline moistened gauze. Got it.
Third, seal the wrapped part inside a clean plastic bag. Watertight.
Sealed bag. Check.
And finally, put that sealed bag into a second container, like another bag or a cooler, that has lice or cold packs in it. The crucial bit here is indirect cooling.
What do you mean indirect?
The amputated part, in its bag, should be kept cool by the ice around it, but it should never touch the ice directly. Don't put it in ice water. Don't put it directly on dry ice. Direct freezing damages the tissue. Just keep it cool, indirectly. And don't warm it up either.
That indirect cooling point is vital.
Okay, last specific dressing type. High-risk areas, neck wounds, chest wounds.
Right. For an open wound on the neck, you need an occlusive dressing, something airtight white, to stop air getting sucked into the big veins there during breathing. That can cause a fatal air embolism.
Seal it completely.
Yes. But for an open wound on the chest, like a sucking chest wound, you also use an occlusive dressing, but you tape it down only on three sides. Three sides. Why leave one open?
It creates a one-way valve, or a flutter valve. When the patient breathes out, air can escape from the chest cavity through the open side. But when they breathe in, the dressing gets sucked flat, sealing the hole and preventing more air from getting trapped inside the chest.
Preventing a tension pneumothorax.
Exactly. And always check their breathing sounds after you put one on. Make sure it's working right.
Okay, that makes sense. So pulling all this together, soft tissue trauma is clearly more than skin deep.
Absolutely. You know, it's a real diagnostic challenge. You have to see the visible injury, the bruise, the cut, the flap, as just a signpost. often a messy, distracting signpost pointing towards potentially much bigger problems underneath.
Like hidden bleeding, compartment syndrome, systemic infection.
Yeah, or just massive internal damage from whatever force caused the injury in the first place. Always look deeper.
That's a perfect summary. So for you, the listener, here's something to think about. We talked about how even a small cut, if it runs across those skin tension lines, can gap open and be more problematic. Now, consider something even smaller, seemingly simpler, a puncture wound, maybe from stepping on a nail or getting a deep splinter. How does the mechanism that deep, narrow penetration change its risk profile compared to a clean slice? Think about the potential for driving bacteria or foreign material deep inside, especially if it's, say, a bite wound we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. It jumps from simple wound territory to high risk almost instantly, doesn't it?
It really does. And to take that one step further,
yeah.
Think about that five-stage healing process we outlined. Even for the tiniest wound, that process is already being influenced right now by factors you can't see on the surface.
Like what?
Like the patient's history. Are they taking blood thinners like aspirin or something stronger? That affects stage one, hemostasis. When was their last tetanus shot? That relates directly to preventing one of those nasty infections we mentioned. Do they have underlying conditions that might impair healing?
Diabetes, for example.
Exactly. All these hidden factors, things you only find out by asking the right questions, are silently steering whether that wound heals well or heads towards a complication even before you've put the dressing on.
That's a really powerful reminder about the importance of the patient's history. Fantastic insights. Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive.
Great discussion.
We'll catch you on the next one.